Okay, the title tonight, A Witness in the Plague. A Witness in the Plague. Now, I haven't heard the word plague used in reference to the coronavirus. But plague is a word that's going to tie into the sermon tonight a little bit. So I wanted to use that in the title, you know, mass sickness, whatever. I'm not a doctor, so I'm sure someone could tell me, well, a plague is technically this, and a pandemic is technically this, and an epidemic is technically... I'm just talking mass sickness, okay? I have 3 degrees. None of them are in anything medical, so I can tell you, well, not a whole lot that would affect that in terms of medical stuff. All right, so a witness in the plague. And so broadly speaking, we're going to talk about being a witness as Christians and how we live and when God gives us opportunity to speak forth. And interesting thing about it, it kind of depends sometimes in terms of your reaction that you get, how times are going for people. In a general sense, I mean, you can look and if everything's pretty much going good for people, if there's a lot of prosperity, if people are, you know, it's good jobs, people are making money, they got a lot of disposable income, if their family life is doing well, they have a house they like, they have a car they like, they're an unbeliever. Now, to try to be a witness to a person like that, obviously, at the end of the day, it's the sovereignty of God. He touches their heart or he doesn't. But those, oftentimes, those are hard people to share Christ with because they're so self-satisfied in what they have. It's very much like the church of Laodicea in Revelation 3. And this is what Jesus said to them, because you say I am rich and have become wealthy and have need of nothing, and you do not know that you're wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked. So you think you're this, but you're this. You see sometimes those, sometimes I see those little memes, those pictures where it says, this is what I think I look like when I'm exercising. This is what I actually look like. That's kind of how the church of Laodicea was. I've seen a lot lately about this is what I look like before the quarantine. This is what I look like after the quarantine. But Laodicea thought they were here, and Jesus says, no, you're down here. This is where you are. And he tells them, I advise you to buy from me gold refined by fire so that you may become rich, and white garments so that you may clothe yourself, and the shame of your nakedness will not be revealed. And so they had it all. What do they need with Jesus? Now, bear in mind, he's not talking to professing unbelievers here. He's talking to professing Christians. It's a church. It's a church that doesn't need Jesus. Obviously, they do need Jesus, but they don't think they do. And so it's hard oftentimes to proclaim the gospel to people like that. Now, if you look at good times, you know, times are going well. Is there any sense in which it's easier on a Christian when times are going well? Okay, it's hard to witness people because they don't think they need Jesus. But is there any sense in which it's easier for us when things are going well? Well, we don't get our heads chopped off, right? I mean, if it's a situation where, you know, things are going pretty well, then maybe the persecution's not so bad. I mean, most of us have not had the tar beat out of us or thrown in jail because we're Christians, not where we live and the day and age in which we live. And so witnessing in good times, well, it could be good. You know, could be easy, could be hard. Witnessing in hard times, I mean, it goes both ways. When times are really hard, is it easy? Is it hard? Well, it can be easy in one sense because a lot of times people are searching. Or they've lost everything and everything's falling apart. I mean, you look sometimes historically at some of the revivals that have started during times of war. And I don't mean times of war like we're accustomed to where we watch the war on CNN or whatever. I mean war. When your crops just got torched by the enemy and, I mean, war right in your face. Or you're a soldier on the front lines in some country you've never heard of and it's amazing to sometimes see the revival that comes out of that. I mean, hopefully genuine. You never know. You know, a lot of times until a few years down the road, if they were truly converted or if they were just scared. But when people know there's a chance, good chance, they might get killed that day, they often think of eternal things. And if God uses that to draw one of his into the kingdom, well, then that was, just like my B12 just kicked in there. Did y'all hear that? Hey, Wally, I just got way louder. I did. You stay awake back there, Wally. Wally's head, and all of a sudden I get loud. I'm joking. He wasn't. Okay. We good? All right. I lost my train of thought. So times of war, revival, sometimes, yeah, people are searching. And even times like this, I mean, to me, this is we don't want a pandemic. We don't want people dying. We don't want people sick. But from the perspective of eternity, is this not the type of time in which people might be questioning things that they hadn't thought about before? Wow, I may get this thing and die. Wonder if I'll go to heaven or hell. I mean, it's usually not that point blank, but people are perhaps searching for things, which is why I think meetings like this are vital. Because, okay, all of you are probably not, wandering and searching, but, the word goes forth, and that's what the church does, and that's what the church has always done. And, sicknesses have always existed. And so why the church completely changes the rules for this particular time is baffling to me, but I digress. Speaking of the fact that we've always had various illnesses, this was a very interesting article I came across. I wrote a newspaper article on it this week up in Kansas, where I still write a weekly article. For 16 years, they've let me write a weekly article at a newspaper in Kansas where I used to live. So the people up there that didn't like me and were glad I left, they still got to see my face in the paper every week. Because the newspaper lady who owns the newspaper, her and I did get along well, so she lets me continue to write. Okay, but the article that I was talking about, I was referencing, this is not my article, but the one I referenced, this is on the Cyprian Plague of 250 A.D., is anyone familiar with that? You fellows studied that in church history? I didn't. But the Cyprian Plague, and it's just kind of one of those, there's nothing new under the sun. I know it's a new strain, but the end results are always the same in terms of, if you might die. Okay, this is the article by John Horgan, who is a historian. It's from the Encyclopedia of Ancient History. He says the outbreak was named after Cyprian and his firsthand observations of the illness largely from the basis of what the world would come to know about the crisis. He wrote about the incident in his book On Mortality. Sufferers experience bouts of diarrhea, continuous vomiting, fever, deafness, blindness, paralysis of legs and feet, swollen throats, blood filled their eyes while staining their mouths. You say, okay, what kind of virus do you want? If I have an option, I'm not picking this one. I'll take my chances on the cough thing. More often than not, death resulted. So the death rate was probably well over 50%, because more often than not. The source of the terrible affliction was interpreted by pagans as punishment from the gods, plural. This was not an unusual interpretation in those days. Throughout the Mediterranean world, which understood disease to be supernatural in origin. Later scholars and historians sought alternative explanations. Identifying diseases from the ancient world is always difficult, as the state of medicine and diagnosis lack the degree of knowledge and sophistication available to modern science. Based upon the surviving accounts, the illness appeared to be highly contagious, transmitted by direct, indirect contact, even through clothing. Throughout the centuries since the episode, scholars suggested a number of possibilities, including bubonic plague, typhus, cholera, smallpox, measles, anthrax, and possibly Ebola. Here's the consequences of this plague. At its height, 5,000 people a day were dying from it. At its height, Two emperors died from it. It lasted 20 years. It's a long quarantine, 250 to 270 AD. Here were the consequences, according to the article. The disease episode of the mid-200s AD caused political, military, economic, and religious upheaval. In addition to the thousands of people dying per day in Rome and immediate vicinity, the outbreak claimed the lives of two emperors. The period in between the emperors witnessed political instability as rivals struggled to claim and hold the throne. The lack of leadership and the depletion of soldiers from the ranks of the Roman legions contributed to deteriorating condition of the empire, weakening Rome's ability to fend off external attacks. The widespread onset of illness also caused populations in the countryside to flee to the cities. The abandonment of the fields, along with the death of farmers who remained, caused the collapse of agriculture. In some areas, swamps reemerged, rendering fields useless. That's chaos, right? I mean, that's chaos. What we're experiencing, it's chaos for us because this is, you know, but that's chaos. Here's the part I really want to get to. This is the last few lines here, and this is my point as it pertains to tonight. The only group that benefited from this were the Christians. The Christian church benefited from the chaos. The illness claimed the lives of emperors and pagans who could offer no explanation for the cause of the plague or suggestions for how to prevent further illness, much less actions for curing the sick and dying. Christians played an active role in caring for the ill as well as actively providing care in the burial of the dead. Highly contagious now. Guess what happened to some of them Christians? They died. Those Christians who themselves perished from the illness were considered martyrs by the church, while offering non-believers who would convert the possibility of reward in a Christian afterlife. Ultimately, this episode not only strengthened, but helped to spread Christianity throughout the furthest reaches of the empire in the Mediterranean world. So you wish that the only way God spread the gospel around the world was to put nice missionaries on nice airplanes and fly them to nice airports to talk to nice-looking people who aren't believers and that they all get saved, and that's how God takes the gospel around the world. Well, sometimes it's things like this. Sometimes it's mass carnage. Sometimes it's war. Sometimes it's starvation. Sometimes it's a plague that kills 5,000 people a day. And God uses it. Why? Because it's He's God, and He uses whatever He wants to use. But where are the Christians? They're out there dying for the sake of Christ, for the sake of the gospel. And so I found that interesting when I compare it to what I see today, which is different. Another thing in terms of dealing with sickness, plague, what's our response? And I know you can't just really do a cookie-cutter response on everything as to what the church should do in something like this. I mean, what would you do if we had 5,000 a day dying from what I just described? I mean, you would have to have a supernatural, you know, really God get a hold of you to go and minister in that type of contagious behavior. But when you see Christians, by and large, they don't avoid sick people and they don't avoid scary situations. And it's difficult to justify sometimes. Let me give you another example. This one you've heard of. It's a guy named Jesus. And he dealt with someone sick too, a leper. Leprosy was also highly contagious, and if you read any description of leprosy, you didn't want it. It was hideous. I mean, like skin falling off, and I mean, it was horrible. Some lepers, they would go numb in their extremities and wake up, and they would have missing fingers and toes. They found out at one point that a lot of times the reason was because rats would eat their extremities off in the night because they couldn't feel anything. And it's a highly contagious disease. You know, it's not one you want. Well, what's interesting is in Matthew chapter 8, if you want to turn just a couple pages over there, this is Jesus at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. Of course, Matthew 5, 6, 7 is Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. The Beatitudes are in there. It's all stuff that most people are pretty familiar with. And so Jesus is giving this, the passage I read earlier about being salt and light, all right? Salt and light. Well, obviously, he's talking about being a witness. When you think about the idea of salt, we'll get into this a little more in a few moments, but the idea of salt being two things. First of all, it flavors things, and second of all, it preserves, particularly in that culture when they didn't have refrigeration. And Jesus says to the Christians, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. Your job to, you know, provide taste and preservation and light. And, you know, the idea that, well, that Jesus, I may have to do some hard things if I'm going to be a witness like that. Yeah, that's what he had said all along. What did he say if anyone wanted to follow him? If you want to, any man that would come after me, what must he do? Deny himself, take up his cross, and follow him. And so Jesus wasn't offering a cakewalk to the disciples, nor does he offer it to us. Now, granted, as a Christian, we have so much going for us if we know the Lord, not only in this life, but when we consider this world's not our home and we'll be in his presence someday. But here in this world, we're going to suffer. And if you're going to minister to people, you're going to suffer. And if you're going to do missions, you're going to suffer. And when you have plagues, you're going to suffer. Or you're going to never leave your house. And if you feel that's the right thing to do, then do it. But not everybody feels that way. And it's hard. It would hard be very hard to see Jesus doing that. Okay, so Jesus just says this salt and light sermon, telling the disciples, you're the salt, you're the light, you're to be a witness, you can't hide your light under a bushel. And you might think, I found this interesting, as you keep reading, it's like as soon as you preach something, boy, you get hammered with it. If you've ever preached, you'll find out. Whatever I say in a sermon, whatever I exhort other people to do, I'm going to be tested probably within 24 hours with that one. And it's like, okay, put your money where your mouth is. You know, you were telling everybody else this and see how well you are at it. Well, Jesus just does this whole salt and light thing. And as soon as he comes down off the mountain, he gets approached by a leper. And it's to me, as I'm reading, I'm thinking, okay, boy, this is the ultimate test. Is Jesus going to be salt and light? Well, I mean, you know the answer, but is he going to be salt and light? Is he going to be an example to the disciples that he just told them, you're the salt and the light. You're to preserve. You're to, you know, you're to be a witness. And then here it comes. I mean, this is very relevant to today. Here's a sick person with leprosy, Matthew chapter 8. Verse 1, when Jesus came down from the mountain, large crowds followed him, and a leper came to him and bowed down before him and said, Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. Okay, first of all, he's breaking the law by coming to Jesus. All right? He's a leper. He's supposed to stay in his leper colony. If he ever gets anyone comes close to him, he's supposed to yell, unclean, unclean, so everybody knows. He is both in a religious sense, because he's ceremonially unclean according to the law, the Jewish law. And even in the Roman world, you stay in your colony. We don't want you infecting everybody else. And so he comes to Jesus, and he's respectful to Jesus, but he says, Lord, if you're willing, he bows down, Lord, if you're willing, you can make me clean. You can heal me, and if I'm healed, I'm ceremonially unclean, if you say so. And, I mean, everything, every problem he has, this is a highly contagious disease, and he comes up to Jesus. You know, it's the ultimate test of whether or not Jesus was genuine when he was talking about being salt and light, or was that just talk? It's easy to talk, because a lot of people can say things, but then 10 minutes later, oh, well, here's an opportunity for you to actually do that, and boom, they're gone. And so talk is cheap, and we know Jesus isn't that way, but look how it plays out. Verse 3, Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him. You don't realize the impact of that, that short verse right there. Jesus reached out his hand and touched him. Probably no one had touched this man in years in any way. Who wants leprosy? You know, you don't touch lepers. You don't even go near them. Jesus touches him. Liberals who read this, they say, well, Jesus must not have realized he had leprosy. I don't think there was anybody in biblical times who had leprosy that didn't show symptoms. Everybody knew you had leprosy. It was hideous. And Jesus, it tells us, touches him. Now, my first question is this. Why does Jesus touch him? Any thoughts? Why? I mean, the Bible's very specific. Jesus reached out his hand and touched him. In fact, Matthew could have left that part out and we could have just heard about the healing and we'd have still been amazed and it still would have proved a point. But Matthew's proving something deeper, I think. The Holy Spirit through Matthew, that is. Jesus reached out his hand and touched him. Yes. To let the leper know that. Okay, so undoubtedly it had a profound effect on the leper, I would assume. He knows to some extent who Jesus is because he says, you can heal me. If you're willing, you can heal me. And for Jesus to not only heal him, but reach out and touch him before he heals him, by the way, he's still a leper, and he reaches out and touches him. Any other thoughts why Jesus touches him? Okay, it's a witness. It's going to be a witness. I mean, you know everybody's gasping. Oh, I can't believe he just touched that leper. They were probably all quarantined after that. They took off running. No toilet paper in all of Galilee. Okay. Any other thoughts? Well, let me ask this question as kind of a follow-up. Jesus heals him, you know that. Did Jesus have to touch him to heal him? Okay, unanimous on that. Jesus did not have to touch him to heal him. Jesus could have said, you're healed. And he would have been healed. He didn't have to touch him. But he does it. He touches him and heals him. Now, and some would say, well, yeah, but you're not Jesus. I mean, obviously Jesus isn't going to get leprosy. Well, guess what? You're not going to get it either if God says you're not. I mean, that's what it boils down to. Now, you'd say, well, Jesus could have healed him without touching him, right? I mean, Jesus could have healed him without even being there, right? Jesus could have live-streamed the healing over the internet, right? They just could have watched it. You say, no, they didn't have that type of technology, but oh, Jesus did live-stream heal somebody in the very next passage. This all ties together. It's incredible. Look down, still in Matthew 8. Verse 5, and when Jesus entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, imploring him and saying, Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, fearfully tormented. And Jesus said to him, I will come and heal him. But the centurion said, Lord, I am not worthy for you to come under my roof, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man under authority with soldiers under me. And I say to this one, go, and he goes, and another, come, and he comes, and to my slave, do this, and he does it. And when Jesus heard this, he marveled and said to those who were following, truly I say to you, I have not found such great faith with anyone in Israel. I say to you that many will come from east and west and recline at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, but the sons of the kingdom will be cast out into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And Jesus said to the centurion, go, it shall be done for you as you have believed. And the servant was healed that very moment. Jesus doesn't even have to be there to heal someone. He certainly doesn't have to touch him. He touches that leper to prove a point, I believe. But the point is not that, well, this is how you do it, guys. Here's how you heal a leper. It's an act of compassion. He's touching someone who is not only presumably unregenerate, but deathly ill. Jesus did something that his society said, you don't do. And he said, yes, I do. Because he had to, as we see from the very next passage. He healed that guy without even going there. All right, looking at our main passage here, Matthew 5, verses 13 and following. If you have an outline, it begins here with these warnings from Jesus. Warning number one is a warning against losing your saltiness. You heard the commercial, "Stay salty, my friends"? No, it's something else. Verse 13, "You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden." Now, the first thing I want to point out in this, on both of these, be it the salt or be it the light, salt in verse 13, light in verse 14, both of these, and you could just fly right past this and not even catch it because that's how we kind of are wired and how we read. Get to the point. Before you get to the point, and this may be a big part of the point, look at the first two letters in both of those verses, 13 and 14. You are. He doesn't say you should be salt. You should be light. Would you consider being salt and light? He says you are. And so being salt and light, which is to say being a witness, and sometimes being a witness in controversial ways, powerful ways, dangerous ways, ways that can cost you your life. It's not a matter of, well, I'll think about being salt and light if I can squeeze that in, Jesus, but, you know, this thing's got me scared. You are salt. You are light. It's not optional for the Christian. The rest of the world, they're not salt and light. In fact, if you look at this in the original language, the "you are" is presented in such a way it emphasizes, you could almost translate it like this, you and only you are the salt of the earth. He's not just talking to them individually. He's talking about Christians. You and only you. You and only you are the light of the world. Nobody else is going to do that. And Christians have to understand that. Nobody else is, I mean, there's a lot of things that others do for us, right? They don't even have to be Christians. They might be a fine medical doctor and not even be a Christian. Well, they're doing a job, and I'm thankful that they do it. Auto mechanic doesn't have to be a Christian, and he can do a service for us. But in terms of being salt and light, in terms of being a witness, in terms of proclaiming the gospel of Christ, nobody's going to do that except Christians. And when you consider that, it's during times of crisis, I look at that verse and I say, I don't know how I can do anything other than have church and say, folks, we're called to be salt and light. We're not. It doesn't apply to everyone. Obviously, people have different situations, but applying it to my life, when I personally apply this, I say, I'm 46 years old and healthy. And there may be other people who are healthy who want to be fed the Word of God in the presence of other people. By the way, that leper being touched, you can't do that over the internet. You can't do that in a letter. They had letters. Yes, they wrote letters. I'm glad they did. But sometimes the physical presence is necessary. Not always, but sometimes. And so I say, if I'm supposed to be salt, I'm supposed to be light. I don't know how I can do that unless I show up for what I do for a living. And if I'm dead next week, then we'll probably cancel church. So, because I wouldn't ask anybody else to do it, particularly if I'm dead. All right, so what does it mean here? Salt and light. What does it mean? We know in general it means be a witness, but more specifically, he says, you're the salt of the earth. If the earth has become, or if the salt has become tasteless, how do you make it salty again? Now, this word tasteless is interesting. We think of table salt, right? Or, you know, whatever that you pour on your food and it enhances the flavor. And they had that certainly in Bible times. But the word tasteless here, it's interesting because there's two primary uses of salt in the New Testament times. One was as a flavor enhancer. The other was as a preservative. And it's not the pristine looking white stuff that we have. It was usually kind of an impure mixture of, you know, different chemicals or sea salt. And so when it, is Jesus telling us here that we're to be salty in our witness? What does that mean exactly? Or is he saying we're to be preserving, you know, the earth? What exactly does that mean? And so I looked up the Greek word here that's translated tasteless. I thought, what does that word mean? Because that'll tell us a lot. Moreno. Moreno. I like the English version of the word better. You know what it is? Moron! So it says, you are the salt of the earth, but if you become a moron, then you just need to be trampled under the foot of men. The word has a range of meaning. It can mean tasteless. It can mean useless. It can mean foolish, because it's a word that even goes into human behavior. It's not just a description there of tasteless, useless. Human behavior, you can, if you call someone this word, it means foolish or sluggish or dull or flat. Like Trump used to call low-energy Jeb. I guess he was a Moreno or something, because he was dull. And so this is what he's talking about. And so, okay, it does have a broad range of meaning. That one word can mean flavor enhancer type, and you've become tasteless, or preservative, and you've become dull. And so when the idea of it being as a flavor enhancer, how does a Christian flavor the world? What does that mean? How do we flavor the world in terms of being salt and light? What does it mean? Okay, and we'll get to the preservative part, because that one might be easier to explain. But what does he mean when he says Christians are, does it mean we're supposed to be the most flamboyant ones out there that, you know, we... What does it mean to be salt in that regard?
Witness,
certainly, certainly. I mean, this is that's the whole kind of the broad theme of this passage, is that we're to be a witness. But specifically, if I'm going to get up in the morning and say, all right, I just studied that passage last night that said I'm supposed to be salt, salt of the earth, and, yeah, Tim?
Essential.
Essential, okay. Well, you haven't talked to my doctor, apparently. He says salt's the worst thing I can have, so.
Yeah, well, he's not essential.
That's what I said, too, when he told me I couldn't eat salt no more.
Yeah.
He's now my ex-doctor, so. Go ahead. Yeah, well, that's possible. Okay, let me give you an example of how Christian flavors the world, if you will. The world of 16th century Germany, the world involved buying indulgences so you could pay your way to heaven. You know your church history, you already know where I'm going with this. And that's what people did. Now, there was a handful of people bothered by that. Obviously, one particular young man named Martin Luther. He was bothered by that. And, you know, Luther, he gets accused of just being completely bombastic. And if you've ever read his writings, sometimes he is completely bombastic. The most entertaining theological writings you'll ever read in your life. There's a website called Lutheran Psalter. And every time you hit the button, oh, I love it. Bing, bing, it'll give you another quote from Luther where he's calling somebody names who's criticized him. A different era in which he lived. But Luther was genuinely bothered by this, and he was bothered by this because he saw people placing their hope in a corrupt church that was telling them they could go to heaven if they paid enough money to provide. And Luther was genuinely bothered. He wasn't just looking to pick a fight with the Pope. In fact, he was very gracious toward the Pope early on. Some of the things he said later wasn't so gracious. But early on, he was just trying to reform within Catholicism. He thought, in fact, Luther didn't realize how corrupt the Pope was. John Tetzel was another story. That was the snake oil salesman selling the indulgences around Germany where Luther was. And so Luther, of course, writes his 95 Theses that he posts on the door, you know, October 31st, 1517. Let me just read you some of what Luther wrote in that. This is what it means to be salt. All right, everybody around you not only is going to hell, but being told they're going to heaven by a corrupt church. Church, loosely used. This is from his 95 Theses. Luther says, the Pope should wish to give his own money to many of these poor people for whom certain hawkers of indulgences cajole money from, even if the Pope has to sell the Basilica of St. Peter. That's salt. That's salty. That's very salty of him to say that. He ends the 95 Theses, Christians should be exhorted to be zealous to follow Christ, their head, through penalties, through death, and hells on earth, and let them thus be more confident of entering heaven through many tribulations rather than through a false assurance of peace. He wrote that with the idea that he'd have a little academic debate over these things, and he posted that on the wall. Within 2 weeks, all of Germany had that. I mean, it had spread like wildfire, and within, my understanding, about a month, all of Europe had it. I mean, it was unbelievable what happened, but that's what it means to be salt. You don't got to be Martin Luther, because none of us are. That's what it means to be salt. Hey, wait a second. You're teaching these people this? Well, that's not right. They're going to hell based on what you're saying. That's being salt. What does it mean for us? Well, sometimes it means, becoming a Christian in a family full of people who are not Christians. I mean, if you're the only one in your family that came to Christ, well, then you're being salt. Maybe not in a good way to your family, but nonetheless, that's being salt. That's saying, you know what? I'm sorry, Mom, Dad, Grandma, Grandpa, but this is what I believe, and this is who I'm following, and it's Jesus, and they may not like that. Well, you're being salt one way or another. And, you know, Jesus tells us that it's not always going to go so well anyway in the world if you follow him. Matthew 10, again, here's our last one from Matthew. Matthew 10, 34, do not think I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword, for I came to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against mother-in-law, and a man's enemies will be the members of his household. That sounds sad, doesn't it? I mean, that's not what any of us want. What does Jesus mean when he says, I came to bring this? Well, we thought you were the Prince of Peace. We thought everybody was going to get along. Right? Because the Christianity, everybody loves it, so why? No, they don't love it. They hate it. Except for Christians. And Jesus basically says, if you're going to follow me, you may lose not only some friends, but some family. Now, the question for you and I is Jesus worth that? Is it worth it? Because I've talked to people who have said, no, I'm not going to upset Mama, no matter what. And I don't know how you can read something like that and cling to that belief if you're going to claim to be a Christian. Because Jesus goes on in the next verse, Matthew 10, 37, he who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. He who does not take up his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. He who has found his life will lose it. He who has lost his life for my sake will find it. I mean, what do you do when you got unbelievers in your own family that seemingly hate you specifically because of your relationship with Christ? That's a tough situation to be in. I mean, in one sense, anytime someone hates you because of Christ, you can look at Luke and Luke 6, Matthew, I can't think of the place. Luke 6, 23, I know it says, leap for joy in that day, for your reward in heaven is great. If they make up lies about you because of me, if they ostracize you because of me, leap for joy, Jesus said, for your reward in heaven is great. But in terms of how, you know, what do you do with the relationship? Well, hopefully you can keep some type of rapport there and be a witness, but if it comes down to, all right, me or Jesus, bye, Mom. Sorry, I'll be praying for you. But that's what Jesus says. And I just think when you go through the Bible and read some of the hard things Jesus says, most professing Christians in the 21st century in the United States of America want nothing to do with that. They want a Christianity that's very comfortable, that doesn't cost them anything, that, you know, nice soft pews. No, they don't want pews. They want the chairs. Pews are old school. We're old school with these pews, you know. But the idea of Jesus talking about, hey, follow me, take up your cross, hey, deny yourself. I'm going to have to do things I don't feel like doing as a Christian and as a pastor. And so it's interesting as it pertains to our predicament of today with the virus thing. What is self-denial in the midst of that? You know, some people say you need to deny yourself going out and sit on your couch. And in my mind, that's the nice way of saying that is it's backwards. It's just backwards. It's easy for me to sit on my couch. It's denying myself to say, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to work. I'm going to, you know, preach. I'm going to. So I guess it depends on what you consider self-denial. Here's the point. At the end of the day, self-denial is not something we got to figure out as it pertains to us. Self-denial means what does the Lord want us to do? And sometimes the Lord wants you to do something you don't feel like doing. What do? Jesus says, deny yourself. Take up your cross and follow. All right, we're moving on in time here. Let me talk just briefly about the... there's no way I can talk briefly about that. Okay, I'm going to stop right there. Because there's some good quotes here. Not from me. Boy, that would be a hoot, wouldn't it? I got some really good stuff I wrote here, and I want you all to sleep for a week before I lay it on you, because, man, this is gold. I was on fire when I wrote that. No. I've got a couple of good quotes here from Martin Lloyd-Jones that we don't have time to unpack that I want to talk about next time. So tonight it was just salt as a flavor enhancer with a whole lot of plague talk there at the beginning. Next time we'll talk about it being a preservative and how that applies to us, and we'll talk about the light of the world aspects. All right, questions or comments?